The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. Over the years that I've been hosting the program, I've had a couple of opportunities to interview Alan First. He has become quite a successful novelist. He writes espionage novels. And back in 2002, when I interviewed him for the very first time, he was just starting to hit the bestsellers. This was his sixth or seventh book in a series of books that are connected by the fact that they're set between 1939 and 1941. He loves that period of time, and he explains why during this interview as we talk about his novel, Blood of Victory. Here's Alan First from the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Alan First. His new book is called Blood of Victory, and we were chatting a moment ago and almost forgot to turn on the microphone. Alan, welcome to Yellow Springs and Antioch College.
Thank you for having me.
You almost turned up here a few years ago, I understand.
That's true. I was interested in Ohio colleges, went to Oberlin in the event.
You have really astonished me with this book. I was not familiar with your work, and I read this, and I was sucked into a vortex. I came out the other end, and I was completely satisfied. Tell us about yourself. How did you get into this line of literature?
I'm actually not entirely sure, but at a certain point, I realized that the spy novel genre was going to be a comfortable place for me because it dealt with international things, and I'm a Europhile, I suppose. I've lived there. I like being there. I like reading about it, and a lot of people like to read about it if they can't go. In addition, it gives you the opportunity to write people who are very knowledgeable, who really know a lot, who kind of know what's going to happen, and they certainly know what has happened. And it enabled me to write about countries almost as heroes of these books in a strange kind of way, of which there are seven. And it's the country that's really the hero, and then the characters basically come from the situation as it's written about. And then World War II was our great moment, everyone's great moment. Their worst moment and their best moment came simultaneously. And I became fascinated reading about it, because I didn't really know what went on at that time. I was amazed at my own ignorance. And the more I read, the more I realized I was never again going to have to make up a plot, which, as you know from your reading, often comes out like a plot. I simply took the operations and events of history, and those are my plots. I'm a really fairly stringent historical novelist. Therefore, a historical spy novelist, I guess, as you'd have to say.
Were you referring to seven books or seven countries?
Seven books.
Okay.
In various countries with various kinds of heroes, but they're always either writers or journalists, or one of the characters owns an advertising agency in Paris. There are always people who read books and who move in smart circles.
You lived in Europe. Was that mostly in France?
It was all in France, most of it in Paris, although I did live in the south of France for a time.
Why did you come back?
Oh, one thing and another. You know, you can only be an expatriate so long. And I began to feel like if I didn't come back, I was really never going to come back. And I felt, well, I wanted to be in the United States for a while. I may go back to Europe. I don't know.
In your new book, Blood of Victory, we have your protagonist, and he keeps washing up in various places that are full of expatriates, places like Istanbul and I guess you would call it Serbia at the time. I'm not sure what that place is.
It's always been Serbia.
Okay.
Okay, when I was there when it was Yugoslavia, and this young woman who was taking me around Kalemegdan Fortress, which is in Belgrade, said to me, "Where do you think you are?" I said, "I'm in Yugoslavia." She says, "No, you're not. You're in Serbia." No, it ended badly with Milosevic, as I suppose it had to. But from 1918, they tried Yugoslavia, and it just didn't work out.
Mm. I am a history nut, and this particular period is really intriguing. I understand you like to focus on the period 39 to 41.
Yes.
What is it about this particular two-year period?
That particular two-year period saw astonishing shifts in alliance and in the fortunes of certain countries, so that you get the benefit in a novel of starting with a country which is like A and then it becomes B. But if you look at the activity, I believe the Madrid finally fell in 39 and the Spanish Civil War ended, although it had been over earlier than that. Poland was invaded. Hitler took the rest of Czechoslovakia in March of that year. And you go on to the fall of France in 1940, to the invasion of Russia by Germany in 1941. Just everything happened at that point. Plus, that was the moment when an awful lot of people believed that Germany would win this war. They had full expectations that Germany would win. Joseph Kennedy, who was the United States ambassador to London, asked in 1940, just around the time of the Battle of Britain, why are these people persisting in fighting? Why don't they just give up and sign a piece of paper and accept the inevitable?
Well, he was Neville Chamberlain's buddy. We can't forget that. They were very close.
Well, that's what apparently they were.
They were.
Yes, no, I know.
Yeah, Joe Kennedy didn't want the U.S. in that war at all.
Not at all.
Yeah. The book is Blood of Victory, and Alan First joins us. Tell us where you got that title.
I got the title from a speech made by a French senator at a petroleum conference that was held in 1918, just after the armistice in the First World War. And the French senator stood up and he said, "Oil, the blood of the earth, has become, in time of war, the blood of victory."
More now than ever.
More now than ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's where it's causing us to do all kinds of things politically and soon enough with tanks and troops, because we remain strategically vulnerable because of our insistence on using that stuff to drive around. If we were using asparagus or string beans or Rice Krispies, this wouldn't be a problem. We'd be concerned with Battle Creek, Michigan. You know what I'm saying? So no, but that's the problem, and that's what Iraq threatens now. That's what Iraq threatened when the Brits had to take it over in 1940 something from the Iraqi. There was a group of Iraqi fascist colonels that threw the Brits out for a month or two before they went back in and took it over.
Well, Alan, one has to think that if we could use vegetables, that Hitler would have been happy with that.
Very happy. The famous vegetarian. hard to imagine that.
Yeah, it really doesn't make sense, no. Does it? Yeah, clearly you're fascinated with Hitler as well.
Well, I have to take account of him at all times. And so these are reasonably sophisticated and authentic and also entertaining novels. I mean, let's face it, this is definitely a good book to take on an airplane before it comes off sounding like a treatise. It isn't. Nonetheless, the Hitler that I use in my novels, he never appears, but I like to have people hear his words, which are not insane, which are not raving or anything else. He was the chairman of a political party and an extremely shrewd political operator. What they say of those times was that Churchill and Hitler had in common that they were both phenomenally good and credible on the radio, which was a crucial element in that period, and both of them prospered politically for that reason. Hitler made mistakes, but he was not a madman or anything like it. He was a monster. That's not the same thing. He was a political monster.
I was intrigued by your usage of radio in this book, because whenever you mention one, we get the feeling what a pulse this radio was. At one point, people are hearing different transmissions going in and out on the radio, and at one point they actually hear what sounds like American music, and they're astonished because they don't know where it's coming from. At another point, you have some women in a florist shop, and they're listening to a string quartet, and the radio stops, and everyone's like, what's going on? And at another point, you have an old man up in his apartment, and his radio's been taken away. And the radio, that's really a key element, isn't it?
Crucial element. Absolutely crucial. It's the way people found things out. They found out two ways. They also found out from newspapers. But the newspapers in the occupied countries were crooked as soon as the countries were occupied or dominated. They didn't have to be occupied to make the newspapers go wrong. But what people had during the war was the BBC, and they got the BBC in many languages. It was illegal to listen to it. But the radio was central to life. In Austria, it didn't play all night. It went off the air, their stations, at around midnight. So what they had until dawn was a metronome so that people could turn on the radio and have the comfort of knowing that the station was still on the air and listen to the ticking.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO. Giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And you're listening to the best of the Book Nook in an interview I recorded back in 2002 with the novelist Alan First. And this was the first time I interviewed him. I had him on the program again a number of years later. And we were talking about his novel, Blood of Victory. And I'll continue with that archived interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 2002 interview with Alan First. He came out to Yellow Springs to talk about his novel, Blood of Victory. Let's listen. Your protagonist, tell us about this guy. Is he from Odessa? Is that where he's from?
He's from Odessa, just as Isaac Babel was from Odessa, just as Trotsky was from Odessa. It was effectively... I can't really make an American comparison to it. It was not the first or second city of Russia, but it was the most dynamic city, and it was an intellectually very dynamic city. It's a seaport. It is theoretically part of the Ukraine, but in fact, it was always a kind of crazy place and has a crazy history. When the French, Greek, and Ukrainian armies went in there and chased the Bolsheviks out for a few months in 1917, the city was divided among those three forces, and the divisions were done with kitchen chairs placed across the street, lines of kitchen chairs. I always thought that was rather endearing. No, it's a remarkable place and remains a remarkable place. Home, as I say, of Babel and of Babel's Jewish criminals and of that incredibly sort of spicy seaside life that's lived on the Black Sea.
Babel was a genius of a writer who was purged by Stalin, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
He's a friend of my lead character, but my lead character is not unlike him. The difference between Babel and my lead character is that Serebin gets out and goes to Paris, whereas Babel can't get out and is taken away in 39, apparently executed in 41. No one is ever really sure when these people died.
And Serebin considers himself to be a Parisian.
Absolutely. He's an adopted Parisian. Like many Slavs, he's half Jewish, half Russian aristocrat, as he says. And that would be a normal thing when Paris fell in 1940. Thousands of Poles committed suicide. They could tolerate somehow the taking of their own country by the Germans, but when their idealistic heart was snatched up by Hitler, they felt that was the end.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. Were these Poles in Poland?
In Poland.
And because Paris was taken?
Yes. They said life is no longer worth living.
That's really amazing. The book is Blood of Victory, and at the very beginning, Serebin, women like him, and he has a a rendezvous with a woman who's on a ship that he's traveling on, and she goes in and out of the story throughout the book, and she's a wonderful character.
Thank you. She's modeled on French women who, well past scarves and accessories, are very strong women, and I wanted a very powerful woman character in this book. And Marie Galante is precisely that. She's tough as nails and never shakes, ever. Not in several confrontations when she has every right to back up a step, she won't. She's very particularly a French woman in that way. If you wrote about French males, it would be quite different, you know. But this is a tough, experienced French woman, the wife of a French diplomat, and a spy. A working spy with her husband who travels under the banner of a Vichyite diplomat. So they can go anywhere as a couple. But she is relieved of duty and assigned to take over Serabin and be his guide as they attempt to work in Bucharest and in Romania against the Germans.
Serabin becomes involved in espionage and his front is that he represents an expatriate Russian group?
Well, he does, in fact. He has been involved with an expatriate Russian group. It's called the Russian National Union in the book. But basically, the emigration from the Soviet Union in 1917, at the end of the Civil War, was enormous, and they had huge Russian populations, 40, 50,000 people, which was a lot at that time, in four cities, in Paris, in Prague, in Belgrade, where the two Slavic groups could understand each other, and in Istanbul, as well as all over the place. Nabokov was part of the group that went to Berlin, where they also went. But what Russia lost in 1917 was enormous numbers of their intellectuals, scientists, professors, business people, Jews, you name it. They got out if they could.
Well, you may not actually have Hitler in your books, but Stalin makes a cameo appearance, which was quite amusing.
Yes.
We don't need to tell him what happened.
Okay.
But when you read it, that's a... That's a great foreshadowing of, hey, time to get out of here.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
I thought I would show him in a moment that I knew to be true.
He really watched Babes in Toyland?
Oh, absolutely. He watched a different movie every night.
He was kind of like Nixon, huh?
Yes, exactly. And he liked Westerns, too. No, they watched a different movie every night. Stalin's night began at around 11 o'clock. And he would have all his party hacks surrounding him. They would drink. They would eat. They would drink some more. They would eat some more. They would drink. He would humiliate them for a while.
Oh, my. The book is Blood of Victory. And Serabin, he gets around and does so under various guises and various identities. And I think if I had to pick a favorite spot, it's Bucharest. The stuff that goes on in Bucharest, wow. That was really spine-tingling stuff.
Thank you. It was a very strange moment in that city's history. First of all, there was a civil war in Romania in 1940, which I certainly didn't know about, but there was. It went on for 3 or 4 months, and it pitted the idealistic, dreamy fascists of the Iron Guard against the practical, everyday, good guy fascists of the Antonescu regime. And it was up to Hitler in the end to choose which group of fascists was going to run Romania, and he went with the sort of everyday, practical guys. His reason being that what he wanted from Romania, the phrase went in at that time, peace and quiet in the raw material zone. Because they were getting oil from Romania and wheat, importantly, those two things.
And the Romanian oil fields are really the key here.
Absolutely. Germany could not have fought World War II without Romanian oil. No way. They could synthesize about half their needs. They had what's known as the Burgess process. where you take coal and turn it into oil. They could get about half their oil that way, enough for the Luftwaffe, but that would have been it. And so their combat array would essentially have been fighter planes and mules. You're not going anywhere that way. I mean, the Blitz itself was designed for low gas usage. You know, you get in with your tanks and your trucks and your armored cars, but you don't spend a long time at it driving all over the countryside. You get in and get out. They just didn't have any oil. And they had it from Russia while the Hitler-Stalin Pact was on, but Hitler knew that was going to be over. The British knew it. The French knew it. And they knew that if they could stop this Romanian oil from reaching Germany, there would be no war. And there would have been no war. It sounds like a real thriller plot, but the fact is this is a true thing about the period 1939-1940.
When I really fall for a book, I find myself wanting to be there. And in your book, most of the time I didn't want to be there because it was too scary. But there's a point in the book where a group of Russian expatriates, I believe it's on a Monday, are at a restaurant in Paris, and they're eating leftovers and drinking wine that's been all mixed together. And I really wanted to be there.
That was a good lunch. I like that lunch. I like that lunch. And Serabin gets to tell a terrific story at that lunch.
Yeah, that was fun. And there were a lot of times when I didn't want to be there, like when they were waiting for the tram.
Right.
In the snow. I didn't want to be there.
Well, it was a very bad night, and what went on that night in Bucharest is, in fact, what went on that night. I've discovered long ago that history is the plot master, and that it does things so bizarre that if you tried to make that kind of thing up, an editor would say, you can't write this. It's just crazy that way, and especially in that period, especially the period 1933 to 1944, the world was superheated in some strange kind of way, and great smoke came off it. And you had extraordinary heroism, extraordinary cowardice, extraordinary brutality. But you also had men and women at their absolute best, simply not caring what tomorrow might bring, but knowing that they had to act in a good and moral way. They had no question about right and wrong during that period.
I like the way you're able to inject very small glimpses of people passing by that really stick with you. A couple that come to mind are the man who must be a Jewish man who's escaping the night of the trams, and he comes running through the picture and he's gone. And then you have this 16-year-old kid, and you end the chapter with him, who's a member of the Iron Guard. These really stick with you.
Well, I always liked that in the books that I read. I always think that those 40 minor characters really make a book. There's generally a hero of a book. There's generally a heroine. There's generally a second banana. And then there might even be a bananaette, depending. But basically it's the other 40 characters, men and women, old and young, this and that, who people the book, who tend to occupy your attention and do interesting things, even though sometimes I think of it as sketching with a pencil. There's not very much there, just one or two things, a word or two, and then they're gone into the night.
Mm. Your protagonist has a number of close calls, and when this was happening, I kept thinking, I wonder if any of Alan's books have been made into films.
Not yet. As always, there are a couple of them in option. My books have been in and out of option over a long period of time. I think there's some hesitancy in Hollywood to make a movie about a foreign country. What we think of as a foreign country. There's America, and then there's foreign countries, as you know. And my novels all happen in foreign countries, all of them with foreign heroes. I don't have any Americans in my book. So every now and then you get a cameo. Mm. But basically Europe then, there were not a lot of Americans there, and they didn't play a crucial role, so they're not in these books. I think Hollywood worries about that.
Yeah, they worry about too much. My guest is Alan First. Having not read your stuff, I have a policy, particularly when it's an author I'm not familiar with, of reading the book, and then if I have time, going through the press materials later. And I got the impression from looking at the publicity material that your book Kingdom of Shadows was kind of a breakthrough for you as far as people knowing who you are. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Kingdom of Shadows went on regional bestseller lists all over the country, and then Blood of Victory was on the New York Times bestseller list. So, but and that was the first time in seven books that that happened. So it's really book six and book seven were breakout books for me.
What was Kingdom of Shadows about?
Kingdom of Shadows is about Hungary, and it's about Hungarian emigres in Paris. A man who was a cavalry officer in the First World War who now owns half an advertising agency and is sort of a man about town, and his uncle, who's a diplomat in the Hungarian legation. And what the book is really about is the fact that Hungary managed by astonishing manipulation to stay out of the war, essentially, while everything around it, Poland, the Ukraine, Yugoslavia, was in flames. And the Hungarians were very, very intelligent about this. I never thought about it very much until I looked at a map one day and realized there was kind of a white space where Hungary was. And I had been there, and nothing happened until 1944 when Hitler made a stand against the Red Army in Budapest. And then suddenly just snapped into my consciousness that that didn't happen accidentally, that it was done, and that the Hungarians had done it, and I didn't know how they'd done it. And so I began to read Hungarian history and use that story as the story of the book Kingdom of Shadows, now out in paperback, I should say.
Okay. Are any of these fictional characters based on real people or composites?
Many are. Mm-hmm. It changes from book to book. But in my second book, which is called Dark Star, the hero is very much based on Ilya Ehrenberg, who was a, he was a Russified Polish Jew. You can take that apart in your leisure time, who was a foreign correspondent for Pravda, and ditto the lead character of Dark Star. Other times it's just a composite character. The character, the lead character, the Polish officer, is a geographer in the geography section of the Polish Army General Staff in 1939 when Poland falls. And he's simply an amalgam of some of the resistance people that formed what amounted to a separate intelligence service that was run by the Polish underground. So it changes book to book.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 17 years to my first interview with the novelist Alan First. And I love the fact that during this conversation, he talked a lot about his craft, about why he writes what he does and how he writes his books. And we'll continue with that conversation with Alan First right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and this morning we are going back into our Book Nook archive for an interview I recorded in 2002. On that day, Alan First came out to our studios in Yellow Springs to record an interview for Blood of Victory. Actually, it was a live interview that day that I recorded, and he had an event in Dayton that night. We've had him on the program since, and now here's our final segment with Alan First.
I see you're getting comparisons on the liner here from all kinds of people, comparing you to all kinds of authors. Isn't that a little frightening?
A little, yeah. I mean, it jerks your head around. You know, you go, whoa, what? How am I going to live up to that? But I think it's wonderful of people to do that. You never really know what your reputation is. It's very hard for you to know. You find out things late. You never find out about wonderful reviews, although your publisher tells you about most of it. It's curious in that you're not really sure where it's all going to wind up. So basically, most writers are thrown into do the best you can and let the chips fall where they may and hope for the best.
I talk to a lot of writers, and I have found very few who started off with writing as their intention. How about you?
I wrote for the newspaper in high school. I was involved with the literary magazine at Oberlin College. I've never been anything but a writer. But the idea that I was going to write historical spy novels, I got to be very far into my 30s before that idea ever dawned on me. I had no idea what fate had in store. So I never precisely set out to be anything else, although I think I had it in the back of my mind that if all else failed, I would teach at a college or a university. But that never really proved to be possible. And in the early stages of my career in Seattle, Washington, I was in fact kept alive by creative directors at advertising agencies who'd become fans, who really liked the way I wrote, and said, if you ever need money, give us a call. Well, I needed money, and I gave them calls. And that's how I lived for a couple of years while I was in Seattle.
Were you writing ad copy for them?
Absolutely. Ad copy and concepts, and I had a writing partner, and we would write these wild jingles.
Really?
Yeah, for all sorts of people. It's not so different. It's all – writing is writing, as you know. If I knew anybody who was young and they said, how do you be a writer? You'd go someplace and write. It doesn't matter where or what. It has a lot to do with – I mean, if you go to some small newspaper in some small town in Ohio and write obituaries, that's fine. Uh-huh. You know, anything that will keep you obligated to produce words 5 days a week.
Over the course of these 7 novels – how have you progressed as a writer?
Well, in the beginning, my story is kind of strange that way because I basically invented a genre. But because you invent something doesn't mean you're good at it. And it took me about 3 books to learn how to really work it and how it ought to be used. And also over time, I think like many writers, I've learned to say less and do more with it. I'm really now on the lookout for words that don't need to be in there. Most of the time, if you trust and like your reader, you can say a few things and they'll get it. I have a really good instance of that from Blood of Victory. In Blood of Victory, Sarabin is at a dinner party on a yacht at the Istanbul Yacht Club. And he's talking to a table full of people about the war, which is what people talked about. It's the fall of 1940, and the worst has not yet come, but it's pretty bad. And somebody says to him, well, if war breaks out here, you know, where will you be? He says, well, I'll be anywhere where it isn't. He's been in 5 wars, by the way. Mm-hmm. And somebody says, well, why is that? He says, I've seen too many people shot. And somebody says, in battle? And he says, afterwards.
Yeah.
And in that one word, I don't think I need to go on about that. I think that is crisp and clear to everyone exactly what he's talking about and what I'm talking about. And your imagination will do the rest, believe me.
The thing I noticed about the book is I thought a lot of other writers would have made this book twice as long.
I don't like that. I don't like that kind of writing. I think at one time there was something commercially important in having a big fat book if history was involved. But the fact is I run very lean in this book, although it takes a while to read it. It's not exactly as fast as it looks. And essentially I let the story tell itself, and I do not embroider very much, and I don't go into long rants or anything else. I just let the reader follow along in the story. I think that's the most important thing for me.
I love the fact that we never know who anybody is. When we're reading this book, Sarabin's constantly changing his identity, and everybody that he runs into, you never know. Is this person a good guy, a bad guy? Are they both? Are they neither? Who are these people? What are their motivations? What are they really doing? It's wonderful.
Thank you. Well, life was very much that way in that period. You really couldn't look at people and or even talk to them for an hour and have a really good grasp of their allegiance, because some people were under terrible pressure, so that a person who might seem to you the very kind of friendly, gentle, socialist intellectual in charge of a magazine might not be that at all. And to your vast and eternal sorrow, if you became too involved in that situation.
And when they're in Bucharest, they have this list of names of people that had previously been some sort of contacts in a prior organization, and they're going through the list and they're contacting some of these people. And one particularly poignant one was a woman that was I think she called herself a princess.
She was Princess Baltazar.
And when he went to visit her, wow.
Well, what happened? I better explain the wow. She's a woman of a certain age, living in a very fancy house, looking out over the horticultural gardens in Bucharest. And he leans on her just ever so gently, and she bursts into tears and is terrified that she's going to be arrested because she made some money over the years, as many Romanians did, by being in touch with what was not actually a political intelligence network. It was a commercial intelligence network run by a Swiss businessman, so that doing business with Romania, he would know everything that went on there. It's Serabin and Marie Galant's intention to find people in this milieu, once they have the list, who might be turned into, might be persuaded to help them in trying to stop the oil going through Romania.
Another favorite was that retired minister. There's just so many people like
Thank
that.
You.
Your book is populated with all these amazing personalities, and they flash in and they flash out, and it's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. The book is Blood of Victory. Alan First wrote it. Are you working on something?
Well,
right
I'm
now?
Always working on a new book. I've been in the Balkans for two books, and I'm going to give it a rest. And I've written two Café Society novels, you know, in a way a lot that happens in Blood of Victory happens in Café Society as it was in 1940 in Eastern Europe. Similarly, Kingdom of Shadows, which takes place in Paris and Budapest and Vienna, which are the logical places for anything Hungarian to happen. Now I think I'm going to go up to the Baltic this time out for events surrounding the attack on the Soviet Union in June 22, 1941, known as Barbarossa. And this is more of a sort of, as it's planned, a wild, highly military kind of novel, a lot of action, a lot of things outdoors, a lot of things at sea. This is a very interesting kind of book. It's different, and I think that's important for writers, that they don't repeat themselves and fall into the habit of writing the same book over and over again.
Are we going to be spending some time in Lithuania?
I dare say we will spend time in Lithuania, and we will spend time in Latvia, and certainly in Tallinn, or Reval, as it was known then, which was the chief port of Estonia.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there still a part of Russia over there, a little enclave? What do they call that? You know what I'm talking about? It's sort of isolated. It was a secret military area.
Well, the Russians used bases. They took over those three countries. They took over the Baltic nations along about the time, I believe, I hope I'm not wrong, it was just after France fell. Stalin had a way of knowing how to get what he did below the fold on the morning New York Times. He was very, very sharp, very shrewd. And he waited to do bad things when the eyes of the world were turned elsewhere. And he took those nations over so that there were bases, certainly Russian bases, on some of the islands in the Gulf of Finland, all during that period.
I guess I'm thinking of something like, is it Kaliningrad or?
Well, yeah. Now you have to remember that the Germans had part of East Prussia that was up there. So that was almost like an isolated part of Germany on the other side of Poland.
Okay.
Which is why there was all the problems in Poland. And I think when the Russians took that, I hope I'm not wrong about this, on the air no less and live.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. let's just say a lot of places changed their names. Koenigsberg it was one day, something else it was
that's
the next
what I'm thinking
day.
Of.
I thought it might be Koenigsberg.
Yeah, that's the town.
Right.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I encourage our readers to check it out if they're into this genre, or if they're not, discover something new. It's called Blood of Victory. Alan first wrote it, and he joins us in the Book Nook today. Are you a morning writer? Do you have a secret place that you go when you write?
I'm a morning writer. I'm a very blue-collar writer. I get up about 5:30. I'm at work at 6:30. I hammer away at it until I can't stand it anymore, which is around noon. And then I will tend to do either those obligations that attend on life, business, or house, or whatever else it is, or I'll do research. But basically, I write in the best time of the day, which is, I think, the morning. And I have a studio, although I can write anywhere, I have to say. When I moved to Paris around 1987, I remember looking at this apartment, and the only place I could see to put a desk in this, it was a duplex, but a smallish duplex, as everything is smallish there, that looked out over a garden on the 5th and 6th floor. And I looked around, and I saw that the only place for a desk was kind of underneath this spiral staircase. And I thought, can I write a novel there? And then I answered myself, people have written novels in prison, man. They've written novels on the subway and in caves. So you can certainly write a novel in a small corner of a Paris apartment. And that is, in fact, where I worked.
And so when you're finished writing, do you reward yourself with a Sobrani?
I sometimes reward myself with a Camel filter, but not with a Sobrani. They're actually not made anymore.
They don't make those anymore?
No, they don't.
They used to come in the metal tin?
Yes, exactly.
The Balkan Sobrani.
Yes, exactly. And the guy whose family owned them at one time, owned that patent, telephoned me and said, I guess he was pleased that I had talked about Balkan Sobranis. But it was certainly an elegant cigarette. Maybe now the people who smoke Nat Shermans are the people who would have smoked Balkan Sobranis in the 1940s.
That's a good New York smoke.
Yes.
Well, we really appreciate you coming out here to see us in Yellow Springs.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Do you have any parting words or thoughts or anything you'd like to pass along?
I can't think of anything terribly bright to say. So I would just want to thank you very much for having me. It's very nice being here this time of year, I have to say. Ohio is beautiful, and it's very lovely here. So Thanks again.
You brought some good weather with you.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was Alan First, recorded 17 years ago and 50 years ago on this date. Two very brave men stepped onto the lunar surface, led by Neil Armstrong. The second man on the moon was Buzz Aldrin. And that was 50 years ago today that they accomplished that feat. They really did an amazing thing. And back in 1996, I interviewed Buzz Aldrin. He made a couple appearances on the program, and we talked to Buzz that day about what it was like to walk around on the moon and to remember some of those things. And let's listen now to this special Best of the Book Nook bonus with Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz, in your new book, Encounter with Tiber, you make references to space politics. There were a lot of politics involved with the Apollo mission in 1969 when you landed on the moon. Wasn't there a possibility that you could have been the first man on the moon?
Well, I'm not sure that that's politics as much as it is maybe a recognition of historical nature and seniority and the just common accepted way that the astronaut program was put together. There may have been some politics involved in it somehow. There was engineering aspects. There were training workloads. Who is very, very busy training for this very important mission? Different aspects would come up with slightly different answers, and I think the one that probably rightfully prevailed was that the commander of a journey like that, for whatever reason that is the commander, and in our case, why Neil was in the second group and Mike and I were in the third group of astronauts, and he certainly had a wealth of test pilot experience that well qualified him for that kind of a position. So seniority probably had a lot to do with it, and I think that's sort of expected from the the outside observer that it would have been an unusual case for the public or the media to make so much of someone who was not the commander, who happened by whatever reason to be selected to be the first person out on the surface. That would have been a little unusual or inconsistent.
Neil Armstrong, of course, was the first man on the moon, and he's from nearby Wapakoneta, Ohio. Neil has kept a very low profile over the years. Do you stay in close contact with Neil?
Well, I try and keep in touch. I phoned him up the other day. I'm trying to find out what kind of car he was driving during those days so that we can be as correct as we can in the Apollo 11 film or television show that is being put together for the Family Channel. The Mary Tyler Moore MTM Studios is doing this for later this fall, and I'm helping them out as a consultant. So every so often there are occasions I called him up to ask him if he would give me a quote for my book, and he wrote a letter also to Arthur Clarke making some observations about my book, and that's covered in the foreword, and on the back cover is something where Neil said something about Buzz Aldrin and John Barnes have created a riveting epic of space and time. We keep in touch as much as we can. I move around quite a bit. I'm sure that Neil does too, and sometimes our paths cross.
Most of the truly memorable photos of your moon landing are of you. How did that happen? Is it because Neil was a better photographer?
No, it was the role of who was on the lunar surface more and who was doing the things that afforded him the opportunity to be better able to photograph. And I took a number of pictures of the sides of the, and as we toured around and looked at the condition of the lunar module, and I took a picture or two of my boot print in the ground and several others, panorama views, and Neil just happened to have the camera at other times, and he was a very good opportunist and selected some pictures that were very lasting historically.
He took some wonderful photos of you. Many astronauts, after returning from space, have trouble readjusting to life on Earth. You seem to have kept very grounded. What's your secret?
Well, I don't know as that analysis would be adhered to, that many had troubles. I guess if anybody had troubles, people would have singled out my experiences more than anyone else's. I had a family trait that I didn't know of that eventually led toward the onset of alcoholism. And I'm 18 years sober now and leading such a much more creative life as a result of that growth experience. And I think, you know, different people can go through different readjustments. There's no doubt that being thrust into the public eye and put on a pedestal in that way has a profound effect on people. I don't know how they can say otherwise. Because it really does affect your life, and it's not what we saw or learned or experienced on the moon, but it's the adjustments to life afterward that I think have a greater impact. I'm sure that people would argue with me and say that they had an experience of whatever nature, philosophical, psychological, religious, or whatever on the moon. My experiences were more with people when I returned back here. There were rather private experiences there on the surface, and they were busy ones trying to get the job done right.
You were quoted as saying that you wished you'd spent a little more time looking out the window instead of at the instrument panel.
Well, I didn't want anyone thinking that I didn't do the job assigned to me to the absolute maximum that I could possibly do, and that required relaying as much information as I could to Neil, who was looking out the window to see where the computer was taking us to land, redirecting our course, and then manually taking over control as the commander to make the final landing, which was a combination of autopilot and inputs into a computer-directed engine and stability as we approached the touchdown point.
And that was our special 50th anniversary Best of the Book Nook bonus for the moon landing, which took place on July 20th, 1969, and that was the second man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin. He made a couple of visits to the Book Nook, and the first one was in 1996, and I got to talk to him about his experience of being on the moon and why all the really great photos are of him and not of Neil Armstrong. There's hardly any photos of Neil Armstrong. Now, why was that? And Buzz explained why, and you heard it on the Best of the Book Nook.